Cab Calloway singing Abi Gesund, and that was recorded in 1939. Before that, we heard Cab Calloway in conversation with Paul Anthony, and that was taken from one of the Morning Edition features from National Public Radio. Well, we're going to jump from Cab Calloway to new wave music and Blondie. With me right now is rock critic Lester Bangs, and he's a frequent contributor to The Village Voice. From 1971 to 1976, he wrote for Cream magazine, creating a style of rock criticism which went far beyond the typical fan mag approach, and he's had great influence on many writers and musicians since then. Many of his readers appreciate the style of Lester Bangs and his reviews as much as what he's writing about. He writes frequently on new wave music and has just written a book called and about the group Blondie, which you'll recognize by the glamorous color picture of Deborah Harry, Blondie's lead vocalist, on the cover. Blondie is published by Simon & Schuster. Lester Bangs is also a musician and composer and has led two bands active on the Manhattan club scene, singing lead, playing harmonica, and presenting original compositions. Well, welcome to Fresh Air, Lester.
Thank you.
Make it. In introducing you and talking about your style and approach to rock criticism, I wonder if you could give us a sense of how you approach it.
Okay, well, like, my basic idea with the writing or the music, it's the same, is that, like, punk rock, any kid can pick up a guitar. It's no big magic secret. It's no big weird, like the elite only know it. Anybody can do it. That's what rock and roll is all about. And I think writing is exactly the same way. At Cream, I always encouraged any articulate person to write, and I said, look, if you can talk, you can write. Just write like you talk. Just write down what you say and then do it, And, like, if anybody has anything they want to express it, and that's sort of my philosophy.
Well, when you were at Cream, was that an easy stance to begin taking?
I didn't even think of it as a stance. It was just the way we were, and we encouraged other people to be that way, and they were too, and it was great, I mean, like, there was you really had sort of like this grassroots new kind of writing coming out.
Can I ask you about criticism in general, rock criticism in general? Do you read other critics?
I think most of them stink. Yeah, I think they're really dreary. What they do is, like, they write about rock the way that other people write about film or theater or whatever, and it's just dead. I mean they're very academic. They're very dreary. What can I say?
Well, how about fan mags? That seems to be in the school of.
Well, that's different. I like stuff like that, like 16, Long Live 16 magazine, and all of that, Sure, that's great, I like all that kind of stuff. I mean, I'd buy a Leif Garrett magazine.
In your own writing, do you find that you have to get or want to get or avoid getting palsy with the musicians or
a far more dangerous trap is to get palsy-walsy with the people at the record companies. I have a lot of musicians who are friends of mine, and there are a lot of musicians who hate me because I don't like what they think are their masterpieces or whatever. But it doesn't, to me it's just like, I have friends that are musicians, I have friends that are artists, I have friends that are writers, and I don't feel compromised at all by my friendship with musicians.
How do record companies try to relate to you, try to get you over?
I guess I'm the odd man out, It's like Billy Altman said to me one time, he said, Lester, you're the only one that they'll let get away with that stuff. What stuff? Impudence or something like that, or like not, towing the line. I mean, frankly, I think it's disgusting and just utterly reprehensible the way that the press in America today just, anytime any, there's a new movie or a new record or whatever, Rolling Stone, whatever, and they just crank out this hype for it, and I will not write hype. I will not write. I don't want to be anybody's PR agent. And even with the Blondie book, we had problems with this. Like one of the editors, she said, "This is a fan book," and I said, "Yeah." And part of being a fan is getting mad at your heroes and saying, "Well, I like them this part of them, but I don't like this other part of them." And she wanted to be all positive, And I tried it. I said, look, I edited Cream magazine for 5 years, the best rock and roll magazine that ever existed. And, don't tell me about fandom, because part of fandom, especially, you've read my things with Lou Reed, is like, really, garroting, your idol.
Well, I'd like to talk to you about more about the Blondie book in a minute, but I just want us to pursue one more thing about criticism. You just a little earlier brought up that you'd urge anybody to try doing it.
Sure.
Nevertheless, the question's frequently asked, what type of person becomes a critic? In film, is it a frustrated filmmaker? In music, is it a frustrated musician?
I think that's such a silly question. Like, everybody is a frustrated rock musician. Everybody that ever, when a record was playing, stood in front of a mirror playing an invisible guitar, which is everybody in the world that likes rock and roll, is a frustrated rock and roll musician. Now, when you start talking about this thing of stars and famousness and all that, I mean, I don't even want to talk about that. But, you know, like, as far as being frustrated, of course I'm a frustrated musician. In fact, somebody just gave me a Stratocaster, and now I'm not frustrated. I'm making the most hideous noises imaginable on it.
Well, do you currently lead a band now?
No, I don't want to lead a band anymore. Like, I led a band for a year and a half, and what I found was that it got boring, you know? It was like we do the same songs in the same order night after 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 night.
Got it, yeah.
And you start to really hate your own music, and like, I would much prefer it if it was a situation where there's like some, you know, potential for, you know, the unknown element to come in. But in this particular band, there wasn't. And besides which, I can tap the best musicians in New York City to play on my records. For instance, Robert Quine from Richard, who used to be in Richard Hell and the Voidoids, who I think is the best guitarist in America. And I will go on record as saying that I think he may be the Jimi Hendrix of the 80s, and everybody should pick up on him. Pick up on the Richard Hell and the Voidoids album. Pick up on my single. Pick up on Lydia Lunch's album. And pick up on the album that's about to come out by Robert Quine and Jody Harris, where they do, you know, guitar overdubs with a rhythm machine. And you will see that this man knows guitar. When I can have somebody like that come and play with me, you know, why should I have a band, you know? I mean, it's just ridiculous.
Well, we're about to pick up on your single. It's all queued up and ready to play. Can you tell us a little bit about it? I'm not too familiar.
Yeah, well, we're playing the B-side because the A-side has swear words in it that can't be played over the radio. The B-side is basically I ripped it off of Howard Tate. It's this on this old blues album. There's one line that I ripped off and built a whole new song on. And it's a blues, and it's pretty traditional, but it's got some bizarro components in it. And I recorded it. It was recorded in the summer of 1977. I would say, this is going to sound awful, but we could have done, you know, like punch-ins and all that and, like, you know, go back and retakes to make it perfect, but I deliberately wanted it to sound like someone who was just learning how to sing. Besides which, I don't care anyway because I think that the feeling is the important thing, and I hope that anyone with open ears out there that listens to this will agree that there is a lot of feeling in this music.
Well, open your ears and let's hear it.
A message to give, and they ain't lying when they say, live. Death is only temporary. Give in. I'm not trying to cop no attitude, just trying to say one thing. Live. deck. There's plenty of static around already. It's just a steal from yourself. Oh, it's such an odd kind of stealth. So forgive me before you forget that the dead are talking straight at you, baby. And they're taking such sorrowful bits that you won't.
That was Lester Bangs, and Lester, I'll ask you to
right. That tell was Live, the B-side of my single. The A-side is Let It Blurt. It's available on Spy Records. I don't know where you would get a Spy record. I suppose you could write to them. I think their address is 250 West 57th Street, New York, New York.
Perhaps some of the finer Philadelphia.
Yeah, or your local New Wave discoteria, right. Anyway, the musicians on there are Robert Quine, formerly of Richard Hell and the Voidoids, guitar, Jody Harris, sometimes of the Contortions, and other bands, the Ray Beats, etc., on guitar. David Hofstra of the Contortions and in many other bands on bass, ripping off all of Michael Henderson's licks, as he would freely admit. And J.D. Dougherty from the Patti Smith Group on drums. And we recorded that back in 77.
And you were singing.
Mm-hmm.
Thanks for bringing that, Lester. That was fun. That was nice.
Thank you. I'm really glad you liked it.
I'm with Lester Bangs, and he is a rock critic. He contributes frequently to the Village Voice, and he's written a book called Blondie. It's about the group Blondie. And in the book, you talk a lot about new wave music. Could you share with us your sense of what defines new wave music, both in terms of the music and the lifestyle that surrounds it?
I just think that it's music, you know, like you can talk about music or writing or anything, really. And it's a way of, I saw a column in Newsweek the other day that I liked, the title of The Cult of the Amateur. Basically, the idea is that anybody can do it, you know, and I see it as one of the ultimate fulfillments of the American dream and democracy in action. There's this big myth perpetrated by Guitar Player magazine and all these stupid super groups and all this, that it's some big magical thing that they do up there, and it's not true. Any kid can pick up a guitar and learn to play it and play better than Yes or Emerson, Lake and Palmer, as far as I'm concerned, you know, and I just think that that motion, that movement, that sense is essential to it's like it's populism, really. You know,
There is a certain there is a lot of imagery that surrounds it.
Right.
That in terms of how people dress,
it's freedom, you know. It's the whole idea, that you have to go to music. I mean, when I was leading a band in New York, like they used to rank me out because I was like the amateur and all that, and I took it with good humor, you know. But ultimately, those guys were really screwed up because they had all been through music school and they knew all the rules and they knew that everything should be done just thus and so. And what I believe about rock and roll is that the whole point of rock and roll is that you don't, it's like the, it's not like a box that you, you know, you take whatever you're going to do and fit it inside the box, but rather that you break the box and you just, you know, like break the form. You know, you break the rules. I mean, you just do, go ahead and do what you do. I've talked to many musicians who are like Eno or Fripp or whatever, who are like master musicians who have found that when they did things that they didn't know what they were doing, they had no idea what the next thing was going to happen, was when they came up with their best stuff. And I just think that, you know, like, well, I see it as...
Let me stop you there and ask you, how long can this type of approach to music, whereas you're just really dealing with the freedom, which is not really examining, for instance, other traditional values like chops,
right,
or other music aesthetics, how long do you think that'll be fulfilling to a musician?
Well, for one thing, most of these groups you'll find that it's a combination. There'll be one guy that barely knows how to play at all and another guy that's been to the Berklee School of Music, and you know, like it's mixtures. It's not most of the ones I know of are like, you know, varying degrees of technical competence. I think that what's in a person's heart is what's going to come out, and I think that in the last few years, technical dexterity has been stressed with things like Al Demiola at the complete expense of the heart and the passion and the soul of the music. And, you know, like, when I hear people say things like, you know, like, well, you know, like, we can have music without emotion. Like, music is emotion. They should be the same word. I mean, the whole reason music was invented in the first place was because somebody wanted to go, oh, you know, and express something. And you know...
Well, that's been expressed, and quite well, by lots of new wave bands, but expressed before it became picked up by record companies, by Dick Clark on American Bandstand.
Well,
not necessarily presenting the same thing,
yeah, the problem,
presenting a version of the same thing.
Yeah, the problem today is that the record industry in America is like, if you look in the equipment magazines, all of a sudden, new wave bass amp, you know, ads. I mean, it's ridiculous, you know. It's like new wave now is nothing more than a marketing device, you know, effectively, really. I mean, the bands are going on, but, I mean, as far as the record industry goes, it's like, you know, 10 million Elvis Costello clones. And it's just a bunch of nothing, you know. It's just garbage. I mean, I hate it. In fact, I just, you know, like, what started in 77, and it didn't really start then, but like what exploded in 77, like, you know, all of those people, the ones that stood out from the mob, they really stood for something. They had a stance. They meant something. They were about something. They had a, and these new groups that, you know, you see in the store, every new ones every week, you know, they're not about anything. They have no personality. They have nothing to say.
In your book, Blondie, you write about some of the like a malaise in the early 70s where not
right.
much was happening until perhaps like the Dolls came along, the New York Dolls came along.
Yeah.
Do you think that...
Well, I just like to say that due to editing, what it should have said was first there was the Stooges, then there was the Dolls, because the Stooges are really the root connection.
Okay, but let me get... Do you think that that malaise in the early 70s is perhaps a result of the 60s audience growing up and not relating to rock and having to have something else be generated?
Well, there's that, and there's also like a whole generation of teenagers who are effectively nothing more than rabbits, you know, like they are not rebelling against anything. They just, you know, they just want to all grow up to be bank presidents and snort cocaine. I mean, really, like, I get along much better with 8-year-olds and 10-year-olds than teenagers the last few years, you know, because like the teenagers in the 70s have just been worthless.
Who do you think you're writing for when, for instance, when you write the book Blondie? Or when you're writing for The Voice?
Well, I'm really glad you asked me that because my audience, I definitely think, is changing. I'm not quite sure who it's changing to, but I know that at Cream, there was a very specific audience, a very, You know, and that audience, a lot of them don't like the stuff that I'm writing now, a lot of it. In fact, you know, one kid even said to me, he called me up on the phone and said, "Lester, how come your writing is no good anymore?" I mean, just like that, you know. And I just think he's a retard, but, you know, I want to do different kinds of things with my writing, you know. I mean, I want to explore...
Are you trying to open people up? Are you trying to convince people? Do you have a goal in terms of affecting people's approach, or at least open-mindedness?
Well, basically, I'm a Jehovah's Witness, you know.
How so?
Well, I'm a proselytizer, and I'm really like always, you know, I'm always on some kind of crusade or other, and this crusade I'm on is like in the Blondie book, and it's in everything I write, is that the emotion is going out of everything, the feeling's going out of the air. I mean, people are just, they want to be machines, they want to be dead, and it's just, it's awful.
Well, then let's get back to the 60s.
Okay. Why? What's so good about the 60s? I mean, you know.
Well, because the 60s is a period that a lot of the people playing today grew up and were listening in.
Yeah.
So what I'd like to ask is, what do you think the influence of the 60s has been, or how has that influence been transmitted? Do you hear it, or do you hear 60s music in how people are playing today in a new wave context? Or?
Well, unfortunately, what we mostly hear today is people just ripping off any old 60s lick they can find and just blatantly plagiarizing it and then putting it out in the marketplace, you know. I mean, Elvis Costello was the first guy to prove you could get away with that and nobody, you know, point a finger at you. I mean, I just think it's just boring, a bunch of boring nothing myself, you know. I just, you know, this whole... You know, power pop, you know, right? You know, like this, the power popization of new wave, you know.
Well, who do you think are the artists in the 60s that did influence new wave people?
Well, the Velvet Underground, of course. I think the Velvet Underground were like a watershed. I mean, I think that their influence, you know, will be felt for decades to come. You know, like everything has come out of them. The Stooges, Roxy Music. They influenced the Stones in Exile and Sticky Fingers and you know, Patti Smith and all of the new waves. And the Velvet Underground were the source.
How about some of the other, what were at the time recognized as fringe people, such as Beefheart or even Alice Cooper, who,
right.
You know.
Well, yeah, Beefheart. And also, we mustn't overlook all the little moron bands like Question Mark and Mysterians, you know, and that, like, you know, or the Ombres, you know, let it all hang out. I mean, there's like, and see, the thing that was great then was that in every town there was one band that had one song. They only had one song, and it was great. And they recorded it, and it became a hit, and then they disappeared. And they recorded a whole album of that song, and then they disappeared. And it's not like that anymore.
Do you have any favorites of those one-hit bands?
Well, I think Wooly Bully is possibly the greatest, you know, piece of, you know, sonic information. Well, that's pretentious.
No, well, who did that?
Sam the Sham and the Pharaohs, right. Of course.
How about some of the other things which... may have been a little bit more commercially viable, such as the Electric Prunes or the people that did Journey to the Center of Your Mind.
Wait a second. Wooly Bully was more popular than the Electric Prunes was, you know. I mean, Sam the Sham had a whole bunch of stuff. He had Old MacDonald had a Boogaloo Farm. He had, you know.
Well, we have some of these records queued up. Tell us what we have queued up.
All right. Basically, what we have here is you know, as usual, like, see, everybody always asks this question, are rock critics frustrated musicians? And the truth is, rock critics are frustrated teachers, school teachers, which is even worse. So, basically, kids, what I'm going to do is play these records. I'm going to play 96 Tears by Question Mark and Mysterians, Waiting for the Man by the Velvet Underground, and Ripper to Shreds by Blondie. And then you can all see how they all fit together. Because actually, they do. Blondie's influences from, like, the sort of, like, Tex-Mex, middle American punk, let's say, and the art rock of the Velvet Underground.
Okay,
I suppose one could say.
We'll be kids now and adults after the tunes, and let us know. Okay, let's go.
grasp for one heart to carry on. You're way on top now since you left me. You're always laughing way down at me. But watch out now, I'm gonna get there. On top, you be right down there looking up, and I might wave, come up here, but I don't see you waving now. I'm way down here wondering how I'm gonna get you, but I know now I'll just cry.
got the works. Here's your sweet taste. Oh, then you gotta spit because you got no time to waste. I'm waiting for my man. Baby, don't you holler at dawn and don't you bawl and shout.
We just listening to last?
Well, first we heard 96 Tears by a bunch of Chicanos who migrated up from Mexico and Texas to Saginaw, Michigan, if you can believe that, and managed to make get a number one record in 1966 with 96 Tears. Of course, that was Question Mark and the Mysterians. And then we heard the Velvet Underground, Lou Reed, who was a Syracuse graduate, and they were all college graduates, actually, a very, you know, New York art, you know, John Cale, the pianist there, had studied under Xenakis and Cage and all that. And now what we're going to hear is a cut by Blondie, which I think sort of combines the two influences in a way.
Let's hear it.
Hey, here she comes now.
That was Rip Her to Shreds, and that was done by Blondie. Lester, you were talking about the influences of groups like the Velvet Underground, or mostly the Velvet Underground, on what we just heard, which is much more recent. And one of the things that strikes you is that the Velvet Underground really never made it.
Right.
It had a small, very faithful, devoted following, and that was pretty much it.
Well, like, I grew up in California, and I can remember back in, you know, like, 1968 and that, when I would, you know, I was living in a hippie house like everybody else, I guess, and these guys would be playing The Doors and Cream and talking about what a genius Clapton was, and, you know, and musically, they just regarded, when I tried to play the Velvets, they would just ridicule it, you know, as would the guys in the band that I was in New York, which is probably why I'm no longer in that band. But they also, like, you know, they say, like, you know, they give me little knowing leers, like, I, you know, like, you know, like, you know, well,
yeah, how about
if you like them, you're a fag and stuff like that, you know. I mean, it's just like, obviously they were so far ahead of their time, and they cut so deep. And I mean, they did it all. Like Lou Reed's lyrics were so precise. Where Dylan would just spew out all this blah 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 blah, all these images that didn't even make any sense. Like Lou Reed's lyrics, it was real literature in rock and roll. It was the closest anyone has come, I think. And then, you know, you had John Cale, who, you know, was like, well, here's a perfect example. Like, Lou really was a very rudimentary musician, and so was Sterling Morrison. And Maureen Tucker, I mean, she didn't even have a regular drum set. She had some big, like, you know, like an African drum or something that she beat on with, like, these things, you know. And then you had John Cale, who had studied with John Cage and Ioannis Xenakis. And I just, I don't know, I like, the Velvet Underground are almost like a religion to me. I mean, I think they're just it.
Well, Blondie, who has been influenced by them, the whole new wave scene in large part seems to, they have been influenced by groups like the Velvet Underground. But Blondie has made it, and they've gotten to a point where now they're really marketable.
Right.
What's the process of that marketing?
Well, I think if you look at the 70s, like, just about every, you know, like, well, not everything, not Chicago, but, like, certainly David Bowie, Roxy Music, even, you know, some of the things the Stones are doing in Exile and Sticky Fingers, the Stooges, the New York Dolls, and now the New Wave thing, it all comes from the Velvets, you know.
What has been the process of Blondie's making it? Has it... well, in your book, you write about how you're little upset that the fun has gone out of it.
Yeah, because, you know, the truth is that Blondie, back then, were the band that everybody wanted to have open for them because they were so lame live that you could be sure they wouldn't blow you off the stage. And so, you know, they got a lot of work. And they're still bad live. I mean, everybody knows it. It's no secret. In fact, I think they got some guy from the Theater of the Ridiculous to beef up their stage show with some kind of arty, you know, Kiss type stuff or something. I don't know exactly what. But, I mean, they really haven't really grown as a live act. They've grown in the studio, of course. What was the question?
Well, let's lead into another one. One of the obvious reasons why Blondie is successful is because of the Deborah Harry, who's a very attractive,
right,
a very attractive woman, the lead vocalist of the group,
right,
and she's really built around her a real sexual type imagery.
I've known her. I know her. You know, like, you know, like, in the sense of, like, getting out of a cab at 14th Street and 6th Avenue, and there she is coming out of the pizzeria, you know, going, and bumping into you, you know, like in 1977. And, you know, or getting it as my plus one to go see Brian Ferry at the Bottom Line or something. And I'm not bragging about this. It doesn't mean anything. I mean, she's just another person. And
well, then how does she contend with having to live up to
not
this real
very
sexual
well,
role?
Actually. I think that she, you know, basically, I think she's very domestic, you know. Like, I mean, I was surprised to find that Chris and Debbie liked the book, and they invited me over after that. And when I was over there, she was in the kitchen. She spent most of her time in the kitchen baking. She said she baked us a special kind of bread, you know, some new recipe. And she kept refilling my drinks, and, you know, and I'm not putting it down. I'm just saying that I think that's the real Debbie Harry.
How self-conscious do you think they've gotten since they've become successful?
Oh, terribly. It's embarrassing. You know, I mean, these pictures. I mean, good Lord, you'd think by now that, you know, these guys, like, would figure out, you know, how to pose and not look like, you know, I can't even come up with a word. It's embarrassing.
A little voided, perhaps.
Yeah.
There's other imagery connected with punk and new wave. Stereotypically, you might think of some pretty violent types of ways of, well, or aggressive in terms of, for instance...
Are you talking about S&M?
No, I'm not talking about S&M, although that seems to be part of the imagery also. But there is a drug type of sense.
Well, there's,
of that,
a drug thing about rock and roll and jazz and blues and music, you know, anything except for classical music.
Okay, but
from the beginning.
What you have is
probably classical music too.
What you have is this association, which is really played up by the media. Right. How much of a part of the musicians' lives is this really, and how much do they have to fulfill this since it's become
successful?
Well, it is
and isn't, you know. I mean, it's like, on the one hand, it's like utterly ridiculous. It's utterly ludicrous. Like, everybody in America, they hear the word punk and they think of Sid Vicious ODing on heroin and murdering his girlfriend. Which is, I believe it's still open to question whether he actually did murder her, but that's another story. And on the other hand, I sometimes wonder in the New York music scene if those of us who do not use that damn drug, heroin, don't constitute a minority group at this point. I mean, but it's not just in the music scene, it's everywhere. I mean, it's just the whole society. I mean, it's a drug society now. I think to single out, you know, music, the music scene as a druggy scene from any other portion of the society. I mean, you can see secretaries, you know, on their lunch hour buying loose joints in the park and smoking them.
Well, as far as what was associated, either fairly or unfairly, with the music scene, is there a different, do you feel a different sense of what type of drugs were popular during the 60s, which it seemed to be pretty psychedelic and hallucinogenic and so forth, and in the 70s, at least in the new wave or punk context, seems to be more working class.
Yeah, but... well, basically, yeah, like in England, everybody took a whole lot of speed again, like they did in the 60s and got all excited, and then the Sex Pistols and the Clash came out of it, just like the Who came out of it 10 years before. And speed, you know, and well, Velvet Underground took a lot of speed, too. I sometimes think, in New York especially, that some of these guys, they actually think... They sit down and think, well, I want to be a rock star. Okay, the first thing I want to do is become a heroin addict. You know, I mean, it used to be like with Charlie Parker, right? Like, you're out on the road, the rigors of the life of a musician and all the racism and this, and then you become a junkie. But now it's like they got the cart before the horse. It's like, okay, first I'm going to become a heroin addict, then I'm going to learn how to play the guitar. Really, it's almost gotten that ridiculous in some cases.
Well, one of the reasons that... it's been written that drugs are part of the music scene is that the stakes for making it are so high now, and that's one expression of dealing with having to continually get bigger and bigger sales and so forth.
What? I don't even know what you're talking about.
Well, the
I don't see the connection.
Well, I'll paint an obvious example, for instance, with Janis Joplin. This is a 60s
example.
Well,
that was the whole Dionysiac 60s thing, you know. I mean, like, I think that what you would find much more in the 70s is you know, professionals, right? Businessmen. Like as Bob and Turner Overdrive once said, we're businessmen and we carry guitars instead of briefcases. That's the 70s rock band attitude. New Wave is a reaction against that, of course. And... to the extent that drugs are involved, I'd really like to get off the subject, frankly, it's the ante is upped, you know, like Sid Vicious killed himself like that for nothing. That kid died, he was literally eaten alive by the media. And, I mean, I really wouldn't blame it on heroin, I'd blame it on the media.
Well, let's wrap up, if you could just share your sense of what directions you think New Wave is heading into, or also your sense of New Wave's longevity. If you think it's going to be around for, become a part of an ongoing thing, or if it's might be playing itself out in any way. For instance, like disco has seemed to do.
Well, Frankly, at the present time, I am filled with nothing but utter bitterness and hatred. I hate everything. I hate the Pretenders. I hate all these pop groups. To me, it looks like, on one side, a mass of phony pop groups that are all Elvis Costello clones or something, you know, like, I mean, what are the Pretenders if not Fleetwood Mac, you know? And on the other side, these dehumanized, synthesizer, Gary Numanoid technologized pieces of garbage. And I would like to see just a few people, like, come forward and take a stand about something they believe in and stand for. And PIL, Public Image Limited, did it this year. And it's really hard to think of another group after that, another new group that has done that. You know, I mean, it just, you know, appeasement is the order of the day. And frankly, I'm disgusted. I hate it all. I think it's trash. You know, it's just worthless. And what I would see as the hope is that in New York, there's a lot of mutations going on of, like, free jazz and funk and punk. You know, like Miles Davis circa On the Corner and Ornette Coleman and James Blood Ulmer opened up for PIL and all that. And I think this is really the direction it's going to head in, you know. But I think the most important thing is that, well, like, somebody gave me a Stratocaster the other day, and I took it home, and I sat up all night playing along with the Public Image Limited album, and I realized how easy it is to play that music. Now, a lot of people would say that that made it bad. To me, it makes it better that I can actually play that. It's wonderful. It's amazing. And, you know, that's the main thing I would like to get across to anybody that's listening or anything in this book, you know, is that, you know, just if you want to do it, do it. Just play it. It's easy.
Okay, thanks, Lester, for coming along. I've been speaking with Lester Bangs, and he's a rock critic. He's a frequent contributor to The Village Voice. He's also the author of a book about Blondie, and it's called Blondie. It's published by Simon & Schuster. Thanks again for being here.
Yeah.
We're hoping that McCoy Tyner will be showing up soon to visit us in Fresh Air. He's in Philadelphia to play an engagement at the Bijou Cafe. And right now, let's listen to McCoy play a Thelonious Monk composition, Ruby, My Dear.